We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
They thought he was dead.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Scoop Live early on a Monday morning. We're joining you, listening to President Trump, who has a list of announcements having to do with new news when it comes to tariffs with China, new news about the release of an American hostage from Hamas. And we're going to listen a little bit in here because the president's about to head off into an international trip overseas to the Middle East. And we expect some news as well about drug prices. So let's just dip in for a moment and see what the president has to say this morning.
It's a bloodbath, but 5,000 more. It's really much more, trying to be conservative, more than 5,000 soldiers. Russian. They're not American soldiers. They're from Russia. They're from Ukraine, but they're people. They're human souls, and they're being killed at levels that we haven't seen since the Second World War. And it's every week. A lot of drone fighting. It's a whole new form of warfare. And it's
the president here talking about Ukraine and Russia. We have news on that.
So. But that's it. I'd like to go back to China just for a second. They're very heavy on the fentanyl. We're charging them, as you know, 20% for the fact that they send fentanyl into our country. And they've agreed that they're going to stop that. And, you know, they'll be rewarded by not having to pay, hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs. So the fentanyl should stop. It comes from China. It's amazing. And comes through our southern border, comes through our northern border, too, comes through Canada and comes through our southern border, much more through the southern border. But so that's a very important subject to me, because everybody in this room has lost friends or people that have family members that have died of fentanyl. So there's a big incentive for China to stop, and I take them at their word. They're going to work on that, I think, very hard. And one thing, when they work on something, they get it done. So now I'm about to depart on a historic visit. Some of you are going with us to, as I said, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates. Before I do, I'll sign one of the most consequential executive orders in our country's history. I don't think there's ever been anything signed like this, certainly not with respect to healthcare, nothing even close. I'm delighted to be joined on this occasion by Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is doing a really good job, I have to tell you that. CMS administrator, a friend of mine, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is an amazing guy. You know, I was telling Bobby before, Oz had a very successful show, but it hurt his reputation. Because when you're in show business, it hurts your reputation a little bit.
I'm going to let the president make some introductions here. And when he gets to the meat of his announcement, we'll go right back in. On the screen, we see several of the leaders when it comes to healthcare in America. And what we expect from the president is an announcement on drug prices. And I want us to listen in. It's very seldom we get to listen to something live together. So let's do this together today. We'll listen live when the president starts getting into some more specifics about what this announcement will entail. And what the expectation is that he's going to talk about a way that drug prices are going to come down that will be more in line with the rest of the world. It's been commonly understood that Americans pay some of the highest prices when it comes to healthcare costs. And as we've talked about in the past, although we pay a lot in healthcare costs, our health does not reflect that. So if you make a big investment, you want a big payback. But we know that there's a lot of chronic illness in America. And so this is part of a much bigger puzzle. What I want us to view this through the lens, though, is not just what's being done here isolated on drug prices, but also about revenue production and cost cutting, which is part of President Trump's broader plan to make the government more efficient. It is not without controversy, and we're going to see that on Capitol Hill this week when we talk about entitlement programs like Medicaid. We're going to talk a little bit more about that on Scoop, but let's go ahead and dip back into the president. He's continuing his introductions, but I don't want to miss the top here. And now we can listen with a little bit more of a sensitive ear. This isn't just about pricing. It's about a broader plan when it comes to the way the government is doing business.
Hard on this. And the question they would ask, being a little bit new to the government aspect of it, is why doesn't somebody fight the drug price situation, meaning equalization? There's a term, it's called equalization. Nobody wants to mention that term. And I'm not knocking the drug companies. I'm really more knocking the countries than the drug companies, because they're forced to do things. But the drug lobby is the strongest lobby in this country, they say, the drug lobby. It's between that and lawyers. And they have a lot of power. But starting today, the United States will no longer subsidize the health care of foreign countries, which is what we were doing. We're subsidizing others' health care. Countries where they paid a small fraction of what for the same drug that what we pay many, many times more for, and we'll no longer tolerate profiteering and price gouging from Big Pharma. But again, it was really the countries that forced Big Pharma to do things that, frankly, I'm not sure they really felt comfortable doing, but they've gotten away with it, these countries. European Union has been brutal, brutal. And the drug companies actually told me, sirs, it was just brutal how they forced them. And European Union suing all our companies, Apple, Google, Meta, they're suing all of our companies. They end up, they have judges that are European Union-centric, and they get rewarded $15 billion, $17 billion, $20 billion, and they use that to run their operation. Not going to happen any longer, that I can tell you. So what's been happening is we've been subsidizing other countries throughout the world, not just in Europe, throughout the world. European Union was the most difficult from what I understand. I mean, I'll tell you a story. A friend of mine who's a businessman, very, very, very top guy. Most of you would have heard of him. A highly neurotic, brilliant businessman, seriously overweight. And he takes the fat shot drug. And he called me up. And he said, President, he used to call me Donald, now he calls me President, so that's nice respect, but he's a rough guy, smart guy, very successful, very rich. I wouldn't even know how we would know this, but because he's got comments. President, could I ask you a question? What? I'm in London, and I just paid for this damn fat drug I take. I said, it's not working. He said, I just paid $88. And in New York, I pay $1,300. What the hell is going on? He said, so I checked. And it's the same box made in the same plant by the same company. It's the identical pill that I buy in New York. And here I'm paying $88 in London. In New York, I'm paying $1,300. Now, this is a great businessman, but he's not familiar with this crazy situation that we have. But he was stunned. But it was just one of those stories. And I brought it up with the drug companies, represented by somebody who's very, very smart, good person, too. And we argued about it for about half hour. And then finally, he just said, because they can't justify it, he just said, look, you got me. You got me. I can no longer they've been justifying this crap for years. They said, oh, it's research and development. Well, I said, well, research and development, other countries should pay research and development too. It's for their benefit. It was just one of those things. And the other countries would set a price and they'd meet the price. And they'd say, if you don't meet the price, you can't sell it in our country. I said, well, then you walk away and, you know, they'll call you back and they'll sell it in the country. But now they'll have to do that. So for the first time in many years, we'll slash the cost of prescription drugs and We will bring fairness to America. Drug prices will come down by much more, really, if you think 59. If you think of a drug that is sometimes 10 times more expensive, it's much more than the 59%. You know, it depends on the way you want to analyze it. But in one way, you could analyze it that way. But between 59 and 80, and I guess even 90%. So when I worked so hard in the first term, and if I got prices down, remember, I was the only one to ever get prices down for a full year, but I'd get them down like 2%, and I thought it was like a big deal. Well, we're getting them down 60, 70, 80, 90%, but actually more than that, if you think about it in the way mathematically. And Farmer has to say, we're sorry, but we'll not be able to do this any longer to these countries that have been so tough. They've been very tough, nasty. It's trade. And Farmer is also very powerful. And the Democrats have protected Farmer. These are the Democrats. And by the way, I just called the Speaker of the House. And I just called the leader, our leader in the Senate, John Thune, Mike Johnson, spoke to both of them. I said, when you score, you're going to have to score two things. You're going to have to, number one, score that hundreds of billions of dollars of tariff money is coming in.
This is what I'm talking about.
But even bigger than that, you're going to have to score that your cost for Medicaid and Medicare and just basically pharmaceuticals and drugs is going down at a level that nobody is ever seen before. It'll pay for the Golden Dome. I see the Golden Dome is there.
Okay, let me take this down for a second. We're gonna try to listen in. He gets a few questions, the president. No disrespect to him, but we have limited time, and I know you have limited time, and I want to make sure that we go through some of the top lines of what we need to know for the headlines for the week ahead. So this is an important announcement from the president, and it's coming at a time when we have Congress working on a spending plan, and that's what he's speaking about there, about bringing more revenue to the U.S. government through the use of tariffs and also through cost saving, and trying to figure out with those variables, then what can spending actually look like in Congress? Where do cuts actually have to be made? And so this is why this is a big puzzle, and you have a lot of moving parts. We have a brand new announcement on tariffs this morning. The president talked a little bit about that before I joined you live. And we have to remember that the news on tariffs is that there's a little bit of a breather that's happening between the United States and China, where some tariff rates are coming down, but it's temporary. It's 90 days. So it's not something that's set in stone. But if the temperature was ratcheted up, I was thinking about that this morning. A lot of our stories are like a temperature gauge. When are things get real, real hot? And then when do things come back down? And so if tariffs are really, really hot and tension was really, really high between a lot of countries, and we saw that reflected in the stock market and some of the anxiety about the economy, and could we be in a trade war? And is this setting us up for maybe even more of a conflict between these countries? Now we see the dial coming down a little bit. We have a new announcement between the United States and the United Kingdom. We have a new announcement between the United States and China. We don't know with China specifically, we have to be really careful about this. We don't want to oversell this. We don't want to over-celebrate this. The president and the administration is going to talk about that, this topic in this way as a win, but we don't know if it's going to remain in the win category. We're going to have to see what this looks like again in the next 90 days. But remember, time keeps on ticking. And in the next 90 days, where do we get closest sink? I don't want to scare anybody. Let's see, June, July, August. So we're coming back to school. We're getting back into the Christmas season. I heard some really interesting reporting from CNBC this morning. Their correspondent in China is talking about how factories there have been hibernating, where companies have had to pay their workers a very low rate. She said $350 a month to keep them on the bill so that they could come back at any moment. But the factories are sleeping because they don't want to overproduce. If they overproduce and they don't have anyone to buy these goods, then they're in a huge economic problem. There was also discussion in this report about unrest, about how workers and the public in China is starting to get also reflects some anxiety. It's very difficult to confirm these topics when you don't have a free press in China. And the press that is Western press in China is limited in what they're able to see or report. So we also have to remember that. But either way, over the weekend, we get this news that there is a deal that's taken place between China and the United States. This news comes out right before markets open here stateside, which means we're seeing the stock markets look more positive than they have in the last several weeks. And you have the president here now making a big announcement when it comes to drug prices. Let's talk a little bit about this for a moment, because it is something that unless you are regularly getting some sort of pharmaceutical, or in the case of my family, if you're not attached to a large corporation and you're figuring out healthcare by yourself, then what you're seeing as far as pricing looks very different than someone, let's say that's part of a huge company that has hundreds of thousands of people and a lot of leverage that they can negotiate. That health insurance company can negotiate certain deals and can see different drug prices than, let's say, somebody like me, where our family's on insurance related to a small business. And that's different than what someone's seeing if they're on Medicaid or on Medicare. It's all a little bit different for everybody. But one of the things that we do know is that our prices are a lot higher than overseas. So here's an example from the Wall Street Journal. Jardiance, which is a diabetes medication, was sold for $611 for a 30-day supply last year. This is according to health research nonprofit KFF. How much was it being sold in Switzerland for? So $611 for 30 days. In Switzerland, it was $70. In Japan, it was $35. Now, why is this happening? Why is overseas getting better prices than us? Well, depending on the country, there's a single healthcare system because healthcare is run through the government. So they're the bigger negotiator. So imagine in the United States, you have 300 million plus people. And if everybody's on government health insurance, this is, by the way, some of the argument for doing that is that the government that has a lot of leverage is like, we're not paying that price. Come back to us with a better price. But when everybody's paying something different and health insurance is negotiating themselves and some people are negotiating directly and it's all a little bit crazy, then the prices are all over the place. And so what President Trump is talking about is having a preferential price level for some medications. I want to be really careful with this. We're just getting in the announcement right now, and we're going to have to look at the details of this to understand how wide sweeping is this? How are our families actually impacted by this? But here's the bottom line. It's the U.S. government getting involved in negotiating in a way that clearly we haven't done in the past. Some are going to like that. Some are going to say, wait a minute, that's not the free market working. That's not capitalism working. Now we got the government putting their boot on the neck of some of these companies. That's what the pharmaceutical companies are saying. So let me just give you the other side so you have both. Alex Shriver, Senior Vice President of Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, lobbyist for the drug companies. He says this, government price setting in any form is bad for American patients. At a time when we are facing growing competition from China, policymakers should focus on fixing the flaws in the U.S. system, not importing failed policies from abroad. Because he's saying, hey, you guys are becoming more like Europe. But let's see. And let's see. Sometimes, have you noticed this with the Trump administration? They come out with a big announcement. We don't know how much of it is a done deal yet and how much of it is an opening negotiation. But what they're trying to do is chip away and get a better deal somehow. That's what they say. There are going to be those that are going to disagree with that and don't like the profile or the posture of this president. I don't have to say that out loud, but I think it's important for balance that we do. It's a pretty obvious fact, right? You have people that love how President Trump leads and how he negotiates, and you have the others that say, wait a minute, the executive branch is overreaching here. And by the way, we're going to see that in a couple of our stories this week. So this is what the president's announcement is about so far. Let's see how it figures in to a couple of our other bigger news stories as well. I'm going to keep them on the screen while I talk to you for a little bit. And Stephanie, who's standing by listening as well, if we see anything that we think is good to dip back into, we'll dip back in. We'll kind of go in and out a little bit today. That can be fun to watch something live. I love watching things live for you. But this is the big news as we start off Monday. We have a temporary deal with China when it comes to tariffs that are going to lower the temperature and lower some costs. And we'll see what the consequences of that. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says that he expects to speak to China again and that that should be on the near horizon. So we'll see if this momentum continues. That's important news. Another important news item is the president's trip to the Middle East. We expect him to visit Middle Eastern countries such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar, for example. We don't expect him to go to Israel. This is his first international trip. So it's interesting that he would make that choice about going to these Middle Eastern powerhouses, but not necessarily America's ally in the Middle East, which is Israel. But there can be all sorts of reasons for that, including security. So we'll leave that alone for a moment. He did announce just before this announcement on drug prices that an American hostage, a young man that's been held by Hamas, is expected to be released. The timing of that, we don't want to shrug off or ignore that it's happening at the same time the president is also headed to the Middle East. So let's watch some of these different news stories sort of intersect, that come in and out together. And anywhere that the president travels in the world is going to be significant. We're going to be watching for news when he's on the ground there. And we never know what might happen. So we never know who could visit while he's overseas or what, how his trip could be extended. And I'm not trying to oversell that, but there is sort of this unpredictability too while you're overseas of, well, there's plans in place, but you never know. So we're going to be watching the president as he travels. In the meantime, back here at home, we have very, very active Congress. And so that's going to affect our news cycle because the president's going to be ahead in time. He's so right because of the time difference. And that affects our news coverage here in the United States. So Congress is going to be on our clock. The president is going to be ahead. And sometimes you lose momentum. So if you're ahead and everyone's sleeping and news is made, then we wake up to the news, but then we get distracted on something else. We should watch for that this week, because that could be something that could happen even if the president is making news overseas. Congress is going to be continuing their reconciliation process. So this is when they're trying to figure out how to take this spending bill that was passed in the House, how to take the spending bill passed in the Senate and make it work somehow to an agreement for both sides. As part of this process, there's a group in particular taking a look at Medicaid. And this is a really hot button topic. Medicaid is serving those that are the poorest in our nation. And Medicaid and Medicare can sometimes be used together. This is part of a broader conversation about entitlement programs, although we would put Social Security and Medicare sort of in entitlements, and Medicaid is almost like a separate, we want to kind of put it in a separate tranche because of who it's serving, because it's about reaching the vulnerable population. But there's a question about costs and costs of all of these programs and whether or not they're sustainable. But for a very long time, whether you're Republican or Democrat, it'll get pinned on Democrats for being more critical of the Trump administration and the Republicans who have the majority. But every political party has been very nervous about touching any of these programs because of the way the story can be told. I mean, do you want to cut costs from the most vulnerable in America? Is that what you want to do? Now, wait a minute. If you can make an argument that it's not efficient and you could provide better service and better health care by restructuring it, then that might be an opening. And that's what we get the sense that Republicans are starting to do. This is the sort of conversation they're starting to have. But remember, all of these pieces are, as part of the Trump administration in general, all of these pieces are sort of working together. But it's tough for all of them to work together if they're temporary. So if you have a temporary pause on tariffs and more revenue coming to the United States, if you have a drug price deal that may or may not be into effect and what sort of timeline that is, that's very difficult for the people that have the toughest jobs in the country that we never see. And those are the ones that are scoring all of this legislation and trying to figure out, well, how much does this cost us? And if you, you know, add the one, carry the two, subtract, I mean, can you imagine having that job? And a lot of it is estimates looking into the future. So it's not just about what does it look like now, what is this going to look like over the next decade? Very difficult to do, a lot of moving parts, but also that's the nature of the work. No one could expect necessarily the COVID pandemic and the sort of economic impact on the U.S. economy. That had to be scored. You know, some of these surprise stimulus plans had to be scored. So this is tough work. This is not easy work to be done. And Congress is going to be added this week along with the list of other hearings because they're back in session. So when Congress is back in session, we get a bunch of hearings taking place. Let's listen into Robert F. Kennedy. I see that he's stepping to the microphone.
Extraordinary day. This is an issue that, you know, I grew up in the Democratic Party, and every major Democratic leader for 20 years has been making this promise to the American people. This was the fulcrum of Bernie Sanders' runs for presidency, that he was going to eliminate this discrepancy between Europe and the United States. But as it turns out, none of them were doing it. It's one of these promises that politicians make to their constituents, knowing that they'll never have to do it. And the reason they'll never have to do it is because they know that Congress is controlled in so many ways by the pharmaceutical industry. There's at least one pharmaceutical lobbyist for every congressman, every senator on Capitol Hill, and every member of the Supreme Court. By some estimates, three. Pharmaceutical companies, the industry itself, spends three times what the next largest lobbyist spends on lobbying. So this was an issue that people talked about, but nobody wanted to do anything because it was radioactive. They knew you couldn't get it by Congress. We now have a president who is a man of his word, who has the courage. President Trump was taking money from the pharmaceutical industry too. I think they gave you $100 million, yeah. But he can't be bought, unlike most of the politicians in this country. And he is standing here for the American people. I don't know what, you know, there's writers like Lord Elizabeth Warren or Robert Reich who are saying that President Trump is on this side of the oligarchs. There has never been a president more willing to stand up to the oligarchs than President Donald Trump. And I'm very, very proud of you, Mr. President, for your courage, I'll say, because I don't want to be crude, your intestinal fortitude, your stiff spine, and your willingness to stand up for the American people. We have 4.2% of the world's population. Our country represents 75% of the revenues for pharmaceutical companies. We spend in our country $1,126 per capita on drugs. In Britain, they spend about 240. They spend one-fifth of what we do. And this is true across Europe. And the drug companies, Europeans, if you ask them, it made no sense what they were saying. America has to pay for this innovation or it's not going to happen. President Trump is saying to our European partners is you got to raise the amount that you're paying for those drugs and pay for your share of the innovation. Oh, that the United States is no longer subsidizing that. If the Europeans raise the price of their drugs by just 20%, that is $10 trillion that can be spent on innovation, and the health of all people all across the globe is going to increase because we're going to have better products. So I'm just so grateful to be here today. I never thought that this would happen in my lifetime. I have a couple of kids who are Democrats, are big Bernie Sanders fans. And when I told them that this was going to happen, they had tears in their eyes because they thought this is never going to happen in our lifetime. And we finally have a president who's willing to stand up for the American people. Thank you. And Dr. Oz.
Well, some strong words there from Robert F. Kennedy, especially because he's a former Democrat. You know, we forget that a lot of the folks that are, that are in powerful roles for the president, including Tulsi Gabbard, for example, director of national intelligence, did not start off as Republicans, nor would they necessarily associate with the Republican Party now. And so what Secretary Kennedy brought up there is really important because it is part of the plan here. It's not just that we're going to negotiate in sort of a preferred role as Americans that are purchasing these drugs, but that the Europeans would also, and others would also, increase their pricing slightly so that the burden is not on the United States. What does that remind you of when you think about this conversation? Because right away, I'm thinking about NATO and thinking about here we're celebrating the end of World War II in Europe. There's celebrations all over the European continent regarding this. And NATO is the largest military alliance in the world. It is true that the larger economies are going to have a more of an outside role in this sort of military alliance. But there's a certain percentage that every country is supposed to meet when it comes to their military contributions. And Europeans were not doing that. And the president during his first term was talking a lot about that. And they did contribute more. And in although there was grumbling, NATO Secretary General has conceded that it is good that more people have skin in the game when it comes to this sort of military alliance. Now, how are the Europeans going to react to this, to being told, like, you guys got to raise your prices of what you negotiated for your citizens? That's going to be part of this developing story. We're watching this announcement now. I'm a little limited on being able to show you the other side of it because reactions happening at the same time that we're listening to it. But let's wait and see. You know, that's a tough sell. Hey, guys, why don't you pay a little bit more for this, just for the greater good? This is going to be your citizens will put everyone will pay a little bit more. We'll pay less. You'll pay more. it's a little tougher. But with some interesting points that Secretary Kennedy brought up there about the strength of the lobbying that these healthcare companies have and how they try to influence lawmakers, and the fact that he dropped that. Hey, by the way, Mr. President, you took 100 mil. Also, this is maybe the first time that I've heard intestinal fortitude used in a press briefing. I might have to go back and check that. But as Brenna said on our live chat, let us all be challenged to use that today in some capacity. When he was like, I don't even mean to be crude, I was like, what is he going to say? Okay, so we're getting, you know, different voices on this. And again, a developing story that looks like, as part of a plan, there's going to be several steps and a lot of coordination to take place. And this is where critics will come in and say, hey, you're betting on a lot of things happening. If one thing doesn't happen, then your plan falls apart. And what the administration has said in the past in similar situations is we're going to negotiate something better than we have. And whatever we can do that's better than we have is worth it. So let's see. We have to see how the cookie crumbles. All right. We're going to talk about healthcare. We're going to see a little bit how the cookie crumbles. Let's also not forget a few things that are happening when it comes to the Supreme Court this week. And I also have one viral clip to play for you that was between the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and Senator Van Hollen in Maryland when it comes to the person that was removed from the United States, deported from the United States, and sent to El Salvador. And there's been a lot of disagreement about this gentleman. So let me. We're going to go to that viral clip in a moment, but I just want to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court this week. The Supreme Court this week is going to be hearing a really big case regarding birthright citizenship. What is birthright citizenship? It came up during the Civil War, after the Civil War, that if you are born in the United States of America, you are an American citizen. When President Trump came into office, he signed an executive action that effectively limited this and said this is no longer going to take place. Big news came out of this because obviously for the president to issue an executive action like this that would block automatic citizenship for children born on U.S. Soil, it's going to get a lot of, you know, it's going to get a lot of attention. And as part of what the president's initial executive actions were about was really in response to what he was saying was a national security, national emergency regarding immigration. So he issues this executive action, but then you have a lot of folks that are challenging this. And so what's really important to know is that as the president issues this executive action, you have people mobilizing on different courts to challenge it. And you have injunctions issued by district judges that are saying, okay, the president issued this. We're getting this challenge. We're going to pause this. Like this, it can't go into effect. So if you're born in the United States, you're still an American citizen. The Supreme Court is not going to be hearing a case about whether or not that should happen. Again, that is related, birthright citizenship is related to the 14th Amendment adopted after the Civil War. And so to no longer say that's constitutional would take an act of Congress, ratification of from different states, unless, and I'm just going to offer this, unless it could be temporary in the event of a national emergency. And I don't know the legalities around that. That's not even what's really being argued in front of the Supreme Court this week. So I don't mean to get off topic. What the Supreme Court is being asked to rule on is whether or not these district courts, and this is a challenge from the administration, whether or not these district courts can block an executive action by the president, or whether or not that's overstepping So who has the power here? Does the president have the power to do this? Or do district judges have the power to say whether or not a president's executive action can go into place? So yes, this is related to birthright citizenship, but the ramifications of this potentially are much bigger because it's a question about the power of the executive branch. And how much power does the executive branch wield versus how much power do the states wield or also these district courts? So will birthright citizenship be challenged? Yes, it is actually being challenged in lower courts, but those cases haven't matured. Here, the administration is actually asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on this particular issue. So we expect that on Thursday, that case to be on Thursday. In the meantime, I want to play, I'm just going to take the president off for just a moment. I want to go back to this case of Abrego Garcia, again, the man that's at the center of a lot of controversy regarding immigration. And the Department of Homeland Security Secretary appeared before the Senate last week, providing testimony about what's happening with the department. A couple of things, I listened to the whole thing, a couple of things stood out to me. One of the things she said is that although the borders are more secure, the Coast Guard is more active. And they're finding that the cartels are moving some of their strategy to the sea as a way to circumnavigate what's happening at the borders as far as stricter security. So interesting point on that. But really when the Democrats were challenging Secretary Noem, there were a couple really strong exchanges. And this is what I want to show you regarding Secretary Van Hollen. He's from Maryland. This is where this man was living that was deported. The administration said by mistake, but also we're not going to try to get him back because he shouldn't have been here anyways. We'll talk a little bit about that. Senator Van Hollen went to El Salvador to visit this person and has been advocating for his return. So take a listen to this exchange. This is a very heated exchange.
I was glad to see in your recent testimony that you reaffirmed your obligations to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And I understand you had an exchange with Senator Murphy on the Abrego Garcia case. And so I'm just gonna put the question directly to you. Are you or DHS doing anything to comply with the 9-0 Supreme Court order to facilitate his return to the United States? Just yes or no.
Now, this administration is following all federal court orders.
Madam Chair, this is a simple question.
It's the president's prerogative on conversations that happened with the president of El Salvador.
I ask a simple question. We have a limited amount of time. I just asked you, Madam Secretary, whether or not you or the Department of Homeland Security are taking any action to facilitate the 9-0 Supreme Court decision to facilitate his return. This is a very simple question. Are you taking any action to facilitate his return or are you not?
This administration is following and complying with all federal court orders to make sure that we
are. Because the court ordered that you facilitate his return. So you are facilitating his return.
Sir, Senator, thank you for the question. But what I would tell you is that we are following court orders and that your advocacy for a known terrorist is alarming to me.
Madam Secretary.
It's alarming to me because he's a human smuggler.
Madam Secretary, I'm going to have to reclaim
it. And a terrorist, and he's not a U.S. citizen. He's a citizen of El Salvador, and he's home. If he were to come back
Madam Secretary,
we would take him immediately.
All right,
back
I'm going to have to.
Okay, following that exchange, Senator Van Hollen made a couple really important points. And just for time, I just wanted to summarize them for you. What he said is this person, Kilomar Armando Abrego Garcia, was given permission to stay in the United States. And although his particular case came up for review, even under the first term of the Trump administration, there was not an argument made to remove him. And in fact, he was provided legal permission to work here. So there's a lot of interesting legal angles of this particular story that really has to do not only with the current law, but how law was being enforced under different administrations, including administrations with the same leader, such as President Trump. So let me just give you a quick review because I think this comes up a lot. I think you probably see this on social media. I see it a bunch on social media. I wanted to make sure I got it straight in my head and made sure that we were the most accurate about it. And this is a really key point. So just a quick review. Back in March, Abrego Garcia was removed to El Salvador. And then on basically early April, a district court issues the government to, quote unquote, facilitate and effectuate the return of Garcia to the United States by April 7th. That doesn't happen. So now this goes ahead of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in early April basically upholds the district court, which said that he had to be returned. This is why Democrats are saying, and those advocating for Abrego Garcia are saying, that the administration is breaking the law and making a decision that breaks with the Supreme Court. And this is why it's a dangerous precedent. This is their argument, that the Supreme Court said, you got to get him back. You're not doing it. You're defying the courts. And we're going to have chaos if this is what takes place. But give me one second here, because I want to read to you what the Supreme Court said. So the Supreme Court says, the order properly requires, speaking of the district court's order to bring Abrego Garcia back, the order properly requires the government to facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody in El Salvador and to ensure that his case is handled as it would have been had he not been improperly sent to El Salvador. The intended scope of the term effectuate in the district court's order is, however, unclear and may exceed the district court's authority. So the district court said the government had to facilitate and effectuate the return. And the Supreme Court says, yeah, you should facilitate the return, but what about this effectuate? They go on. The intended scope of the term effectuate in the district court's order is, however, unclear and may exceed the district court's authority. The district court should clarify its directive with due regard for the deference owed to the executive branch in the conduct of foreign affairs. So the Supreme Court is saying, you need to figure that out, because you don't get to tell the executive branch how to do their work. Similarly, the executive branch isn't supposed to tell you how to do your work. And we got to be a little bit clear about this, about how this is being handled in the balance of power. For its part, this continues, the government should be prepared to share what it can concerning the steps it has taken and the prospect of further steps. So again, going back to, hey, but the government should get this guy back. So this is why you're seeing a division of interpretation of this ruling. You have those on one side saying, listen, the Supreme Court says you got to do what the district court says, which is you got to get this guy back. And then if you want to do something with him, do something. If you want to put him through another legal proceeding, you want to present a case that he should not be allowed to stay here, do it that way. But you can't just mistakenly remove him when he had permission to stay in this country and he wasn't given more due process. And therefore, we have to have him back. What the administration is saying, well, how do we do that? We have to ask El Salvador to give him back. And he's currently in the custody of El Salvador. And we believe, I'm speaking as through the way the administration is speaking, that he's a terrorist. He's associated with the terrorist organization. And yes, we didn't prosecute him when he was here. And in fact, we didn't really argue for his release either. Like his release, like to be removed. And in fact, like he might've had some running with the law. I saw some video about that, but like there was this complaint about domestic abuse, but there were no charges ever. So you see how this is a great, each side has an argument to say this person should be returned to the United States, or we're not going to return this person because it's up to the executive branch to deal with foreign policy, not district courts. And we think he's a threat to the United States of America. So we don't have to, we're in that little gray area. We're going to live in that. So it's important to know that. There's so many strong opinions about this case. And I just wanted to kind of empower you on either side to understand in this particular case, both sides are willfully ignoring one part of the ruling that they have to figure out how to approach. So Senator Van Hollen has to essentially make an effective argument. And he would say that he doesn't, because the district court struck that word. They took away the word effectuate. When they had this Supreme Court, the Supreme Court came down with their ruling. They're like, okay, we'll just take out the word. It's not, they're just the facilitative. It's not that quite that easy. Well, it depends on who you ask. And so this is where Senator Van Hollen would have to make an argument that, no, the district court knows better about this particular issue than the executive branch when it comes to foreign policy. And the executive branch has to make a really good argument about why they would not start to try to facilitate the return of this individual, because the Supreme Court said that they should. And we've heard from them, obviously, why they say that they're not, because he's currently in El Salvador and no longer in their custody. But where there's a will, there's a way. So there's also that they have to kind of work through. Real quick, and then I'm going to let you go. It's the president is still speaking, so we could also dip back in. We'll see if he's saying anything with reporters. I just want to show you something really quick here, and this is what happened over the weekend with Ukraine, and because a lot of American energy and taxpayer money has been invested here, I just want to keep you updated on what's happening there. Ukraine's president had a big meeting with several other European leaders, including the leader of the UK, Poland, France, and they put together a proposal for a ceasefire. And that proposal is on the table to the end of the day on Monday. If Russia doesn't agree to ceasefire, then a whole round of other sanctions are going to go into effect, these European leaders say. And what's interesting to watch about this deal is that you see this united front by Europe that doesn't include the United States of America. And so as we went into this week, there was a question, well, did these Europeans come together, these European leaders come together and have enough leverage to try to get Vladimir Putin to the negotiating table? We have President Zelensky of Ukraine saying he wants to meet with President Putin in Turkey on Thursday. He wants direct talks. So there's a lot going on here. But going into the week, this was on the table. What happened last night? 100 drones were sent into Kyiv. These Iranian drones sent into Kyiv as part of an attack by Russia. So Russia's just completely dismissing this as we don't even have a response right now from Russia. Russia's spokesperson has been basically like shrugging off, oh, well, you're going to put in sanctions. Like, okay. Like this is, you know, it's very, I'm just trying to categorize it in a way that's quick and easy. Dismissive is probably the best way to describe it. Very dismissive. Doesn't look promising, but anything can happen. So let's see. What was really important here is a test of European strength. Is there enough leverage there to try to get Russia to the table? Right now, it doesn't look like it. So this was also the Europeans trying to show that they could do business without President Trump. The question is, can they effectively do that? And do they need the United States of America as part of the equation to move this along? And we know there's obviously disagreements there. Just wanted to let you know that. Let's see. A couple questions I'm seeing here. I'm going to have to look into. Caitlin's asking a great question about the agreement between the United States and El Salvador when it came to custody. Remember, the United States is paying El Salvador money to take these individuals into custody, of which Abrego Garcia is part of. And she's asking about the terms, about whether or not the terms included, Caitlin's saying here, that El Salvador, that the U.S. dictates control over these people for 1 year. That would be interesting to understand that, Caitlin. I don't know the particulars of that, to understand, well, who actually has, you know, authority over these now prisoners. So again, a case that we'll have to watch. And yes, Gretchen, thank you for this. Gretchen said, I missed the talk about Russian and the Chinese leaders meeting. Yes, Russia and China had a big meeting that took place late last week. And this took place in Russia with many other European leaders to mark the end of World War II. And so this face-to-face meeting between President Putin and President Xi, this has happened periodically over the last several years. And yes, it's also true that President Xi hasn't been meeting with the American president at the same rate as he has with the Russian president. And what they talked about is a closer alliance. Again, a closer alliance between the two of them. President Trump did say right before we got on, or while we were starting, that he expects to speak to the Chinese president later this week. So we'll see if there's any of a change there. But yes, we always want to keep an eye on those sort of meetings. They kind of happen and, you know, we're distracted by other things at home. And, you know, there's, I don't want to say these are media events, but they're summits. You know, it's like a conference, people coming together. Oh, we're going to, you know, talk about peace and prosperity. And, you know, there's a lot of, it's a big photo op, but it matters, especially to see that these relationships are happening, continuing, and in their words, growing stronger. So it is important. Any other final questions before I leave you for the day, guys? See, it looks like President Trump is done speaking now. Just a final, I hope this makes you laugh, but also there's a little bit of news. So I'll take it. A little bit of news. I'm always concerned when I see anything about, by the way, there is a listeria outbreak regarding some ready-to-make food. We'll put that in our show notes so you can see what we're talking about there. Small listeria outbreak, but we always got to be careful about those because they can be super, super dangerous, especially to the elderly and also to pregnant mothers. But also, Let me share this with you so you can see. This is from the CDC, and we're watching a salmonella outbreak that's linked to backyard poultry. And so we have 7 cases, no hospitalizations, no deaths, thankfully, but we see 6 states where this is reported. So, you know, the CDC, we're always going to watch, like, what sort of advice do they give? So we're just looking for the news. We're trying to collect the facts for you because we care about you. And so, all right, you know, backyard poultry, chickens and ducks, they can carry salmonella. Okay, got to be careful touching them, touching your mouth or food, swallowing these germs. That doesn't sound good. So let's say wash your hands. Okay, that's good advice. Hand sanitizer, all right, that's good advice. Be safe around backyard flocks, all right? This is where we were caught off guard, and we're going to be caught off guard together. Don't kiss or snuggle backyard poultry. Is anyone live on our chat that does that? You could kind of cuddle a hen, a little chicky, right? Don't kiss or snuggle backyard poultry, and don't eat or drink around them. This can spread salmonella germs to your mouth and make you sick. So that's my advice I'm leaving with you today. Don't kiss or snuggle your backyard poultry, guys. You know, pick something else. Stephanie's on the live chat. Yes. She says, I have at least one friend that needs to hear this message. As I'm saying it out loud, Stephanie, there's a couple people I'm going to be firing off the CDC screenshot to. Word to the wise, no kissing your poultry. All right. Let's look at the range of news that we've covered today. I feel good about what we've done. We got a lot of developing stories this week. Thank you for joining us early as we got you an early scoop on the week ahead. Let us know if this time works better for you live, because although it adds a lot of excitement to the morning, kind of gets us started on the right foot, doesn't it? That we're kind of ready for the day. And maybe in the summertime in particular, that could maybe be helpful, as I know a lot of schedules change. So look forward to hearing your questions or comments. You can always email us, scoop@smarternews.com. I'm going to check into some of those questions that you asked and hopefully have an answer for you next week. And appreciate your support for quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News. It's always a joy to spend some time together and to deliver news to you during these historic times. Have a great week, you guys. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.